Let's be honest, between the back-to-back patients, inbox overload, and real life, our schedules can be a bit of a mess. And that's why I'm a fan of Oakstone CME's programs, including their ACP MixTap Audio Companion and Board Prep. It's CME designed for how we actually live and work. You get audio, video, text-based formats, all easy access through their mobile app or their desktop. So you throw on a MixTap episode while walking to work or even prepping dinner. It's surprisingly satisfying to check off a topic while multitasking. The platform's intuitive, streamlined, there's no fuss, whether it's 10 minutes to an hour that you have, just jump in, make progress, and move on with your day. Honestly, it's become one of my favorite ways to keep learning without carving out extra quote-unquote study time. So if you got commute time, gym time, or just some downtime, you've got some CME time. Use the code CORE30 for 30% off from November 1st to January 31st, 2026. This is exclusive for Corian listeners, so go to oakstone.com/mixapp. That's oakstone.com/MKSAP. And don't forget to use the code CORE30.
Welcome to Corian. Today, we are spinning things around with the diabetes debate, and we're going to dig into a very real-world clinical question. In this day and age, we have so many different diabetes options, which is great, but a very good question is, what do you start and why? And so today, we have a good lineup of meds. We actually kept it simple to hammer home some of the learning points to three medications. We've got Formin, SGLT2 inhibitors, and GLP-1 agonists. And we also have three very experienced frontline primary care docs who each have chosen a medication to defend for our diabetes battle. Of course, it's going to be a respectful one. But Tracy, I'll hand it over to you first. Introduce yourself and which medication you are defending today.
Thanks so much, Shreya. My name is Tracy Rabin, and I'm a primary care doctor at Yale Primary Care here in New Haven, Connecticut. I direct our diabetes clinic, which is an interprofessional referral-based clinic within our practice. And I'm here today representing Team Metformin.
Now, the next we have Carrie.
Hi, I'm Carrie Blum. I'm a primary care doctor at Mount Sinai Hospital, where I also co-direct a diabetes clinic. And today I'll be proudly representing the SGLT2 inhibitors, also known as the Flozins. You may have heard some of names such as Jardiance, Farxiga. That's my class today.
Awesome. And then last but not least.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kenneth Pfeiffer. I'm a primary care doctor at Mount Sinai, and I co-direct our diabetes clinic here with Carrie. And I'm excited today to defend the GLP-1 agonist. So those are medications like dulaglutide or Trulicity, semaglutide, or also known as Ozempic or Wegovy, and tirzepatide, also known as Mounjaro or Zepbound.
All right. So let's start with a case. I think this is one that we see from time to time. So a good one to start with. This is the 47-year-old male who, after years, is coming in, hasn't seen a primary care doctor for a long time. His A1C is 7.6%. His eGFR is 78 and his BMI is 28. He's never been on medication and is pretty clear he does not want insulin, especially after seeing his mom decline on dialysis. He tries 3 months of lifestyle modifications, but his A1C is still unchanged. So the question of helping with medicine comes up.
Well, right out of the gate, I'm going to say that this is a perfect situation where metformin might be useful. This gentleman is somebody who hasn't been on medication, so he's looking for something that's going to be easy. Clearly, he's not wanting insulin, probably doesn't want anything injectable, so a pill would be fantastic. You know, metformin is fairly well tolerated, especially in the extended release version, which should have fewer side effects than the immediate release. And it's easy to titrate and should be able to get him to his goal. He's already at 7.6, but the metformin will certainly get him below 7 and even below 6.5 as needed.
Excellent. Carrie, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I hear what you're saying, Tracy, although I would respectfully also make an argument that SGLT2 inhibitors may have a role in this particular case. There's a few things about the case that I'm seeing that would make an SGLT2 inhibitor a good choice. As you mentioned, he doesn't need a lot of A1C lowering, so we might not need the most potent agent, and we might want to choose one with a pretty favorable side effect profile. SGLT2 inhibitors do not have the same types of GI side effects that we see with the classes you guys are defending, so it might be just as simple as one pill a day. It will get his A1C down below the goal of 7, not to mention his eGFR at 78. It's not exactly CKD, but it's also not exactly normal. So if we have the opportunity to start an SGLT2 inhibitor early, I could really see potentially changing the natural history of this patient's potential CKD.
Sorry, just a couple of follow-up questions. You mentioned the A1C reduction. What is the difference between the A1C reduction you might expect with metformin versus an SGLT2 inhibitor? And then you mentioned his eGFR of 70 to 47 is not quite normal. Can you expand on those two things?
Yeah, so let me add a few numbers to the claims there. A1C reduction that we see with SGLT2 inhibitors is not the most potent agent, but we definitely can see up to about a 1% drop, especially with a higher dose. All SGLT2 inhibitors come in two dose options, and increasing to the higher dose can give you a bit more potency. Normal GFR, you need one less than 60 to get the diagnosis of CKD. You know, most people are starting up well above 100. So we can kind of see that he's in that middle ground of 78. And I would like to see a urine albumin creatinine ratio on this gentleman to see whether he might have a little bit of nephropathy brewing, in which case I think we have a much better argument for the SGLT2 inhibitors over metformin in this case.
Kenny, he's not a fan of insulin, so any thoughts on where GLP-1s may make sense or let metformin and SGLT2 duke it out for this one?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's certainly reasonable to try metformin or an SGLT2 inhibitor. However, you know, I think this is a, you know, younger gentleman who doesn't have a lot of other comorbidities, and maybe it makes sense for us to be more aggressive about A1C lowering in this case to help prevent microvascular complications down the line. And GLP-1 agonists are probably more potent in terms of A1C lowering than metformin or SGLT2 inhibitors. You know, a big flag here is that he doesn't want insulin, right? And so maybe he doesn't want any injectable at all. Maybe that's true, but we also haven't really asked him. And I can't tell you how many times in clinic I've started to introduce the idea of a weekly injectable to a patient, and their initial reaction is quite hesitant. But that's where kind of showing them what the process looks like can be really helpful. So I'll either do that, you know, by a YouTube video online or by using a demo pen myself and showing them the process of injecting it. Weekly GLP-1, which is actually pretty simple, and I think a lot simpler than people have in mind, really can change minds. And I've had many, many patients opt to try it and have success. So I would argue that we really could still go for it. So, you know, in this case, his BMI is actually 28, and, you know, several sort of associations, including the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, the Obesity Society, recommend considering weight loss medication when you have a BMI over 27 and at least one serious comorbidity like diabetes. So I think, you know, it's very reasonable to consider a GLP-1 agonist in him.
Nice. Thank you for making that case. I thought GLP-1 was out of the picture once we heard about that insulin thing. I think that was a really good point about, you know, trying and showing and seeing if that changes minds. And so I appreciate that persistence.
Well, so Carrie and Kenny, I really appreciate the thoughts that you bring to the table and regarding your classes. But I do want to bring up one additional really important factor, and that's the cost. Right. So metformin is going to be winning for this patient, hands down. This is a gentleman who is not used to spending money on medical care, on medications. He hasn't been doing so in quite some time. I think if he sees the price tag for that GLP-1 receptor agonist or that SGLT2 inhibitor, he may get some sticker shock. So just depending on what his insurance situation is, just be mindful that metformin is going to be our more cost-effective option here. And it will also have some help with the weight loss. Not as certainly as much as the GLP-1s, but there is some little bit of weight loss with metformin too.
Maybe if I speak to if somebody has or doesn't have insurance, what the price of an SGLT2 and GLP-1 might be for a person?
Sure, I can start. You know, fortunately, you know, at least where, you know, Carrie and I practice in New York, you know, patients with diabetes basically have GLP-1s covered. So fortunately, we don't run into this issue that much. But when it does come up, GLP-1s, Tracy's absolutely right. GLP-1s can be quite expensive. And if sort of paying out of pocket with the traditional prescriptions, it can be somewhere around $1,000 or $1,200 a month. There are some, you can prescribe it directly to the manufacturer's pharmacy, which will dispense it in syringes rather than injectable retractable pens. And they sort of advertise the medication in the realm of $300 to $400 a month. So it's still quite expensive.
If someone doesn't have insurance.
If someone doesn't have insurance, correct.
Okay, interesting. And then do we know more about SGLT2 inhibitors, Carrie, and how much they cost?
Unfortunately, Tracy's got me on that one. You know, they're very expensive. Even with a coupon, will probably cost you upwards of $500 a month.
This is without insurance.
That's right, yeah. But as Kenny mentioned, by and large, for any patient with diabetes who has insurance, you're able to find a preferred SGLT2 inhibitor with a low copay.
Fantastic. All right. Second case, guys. If you guys weren't, you know, defending something today and you're in diabetes clinic, what would you start for this guy in real life?
really, that's a taking my GLP-1 hat off. I actually think I probably would start with sort of metformin and emphasizing the lifestyle changes and modifications it's in. Really sort of, yeah, emphasizing healthy eating along with metformin as a first shot, probably.
Yeah, I think I'd probably have to give this one to metformin as well. Although I will double down on that thing I mentioned earlier, which is that if he's got proteinuria, and especially if he's got concern about GI side effects, I would switch pretty quickly over to an SGLT2 inhibitor in this case.
Yeah, and I think just to add it, I think you both have made compelling points, and Carrie in particular. You know, I think if there is any renal compromise already, that is something that I would want to take into account, but I'm happy to be declared the winner for this round.
Yay, Tracy. Okay, or yay, metformin. All right, so second case, and we have a 52-year-old preschool teacher. He has a 3-year history of diabetes, obesity with a BMI of 32, well-controlled hypertension. He's doing pretty well with diet and exercise until he had some financial stress that forced him to take a second job. Then the last 6 months, he's kind of just lost control of things, gained 23 pounds. His A1C has jumped from that kind of nice 6.3% to an 8.6 A1C. Any strong feelings for their medication?
So I'm going to jump on this one, given his priority for weight loss. I think, you know, it's pretty clear that GLP-1 agonists are the most potent in terms of weight loss, and studies have shown sort of 15 to 20% weight loss with full dose GLP-1 agonists, which is pretty, you know, significant for weight loss trials. And additionally, you know, his A1C has jumped up to 2 points, and GLP-1 agonists have shown A1C lowering for up to a point and a half to 2 percentage points compared to placebo. So I think there's a lot of reasons to focus on GLP-1 agonist for him. That being said, that has to go along, of course, with, you know, lifestyle modifications as well, and counseling on healthy eating and physical activity, you know, really should all go together.
Yeah, so I can jump in here too. I mean, I hear what you're saying, Kenny, and certainly, you know, the GLP-1 receptor agonists are superior in terms of the weight reduction component, but I still think that there's a possible role for metformin to play here. I mean, I think as far as A1C lowering, you can get anywhere from 1% to 2% depending on the dose and consistency. So, you know, he's only at 8.6, so I still think we can get this gentleman to goal with metformin. You will see a little bit of weight loss. I know that in terms of the RCTs, you know, I think 3% is sort of more the agreed upon degree of weight loss that one could expect with metformin above a dose of 1500 milligrams a day. But again, you know, he's got financial stressors, so this is not going to be an issue for his wallet. Hopefully it will be well tolerated, again, if you use the extended release version, and should be fairly easy for him to take.
I do agree the financial stressor, we certainly have to take that into account, both in terms of the medication itself. Now, hopefully the GLP-1 agonist would be covered, but also in terms of how we do end up counseling on nutrition and exercise. It may not be realistic for us to counsel on, you know, purchasing more expensive healthy food if he doesn't have the current financial means. So I think I'm absolutely need to consider that all.
Definitely a good point. You know, I'm sort of on the optimistic side, hoping that this second job is also one that comes along with health insurance. And as long as that's the case, he should be able to get an SGLT2 inhibitor covered. And while it may not necessarily be your first choice, if you go back to the one-liner, 52-year-old male with diabetes, hypertension, and obesity, you can stop there and think about, you know, which medication can be used to actually impact each of those comorbidities in the one-liner. And, you know, frankly, SGLT2 inhibitors, while potentially small, will have a bit of an impact on blood pressure, about 3 points systolic. Also will help with a little bit of weight loss. Again, not a ton, maybe about 3% of body weight on average. And as we discussed earlier, you may get about a point or so A1C reduction, all for just a once-a-day pill with very few side effects. And I want to make sure that he's at his job performing at the top of his game and not experiencing any nausea or abdominal pain. But SGLT2 inhibitors, another great choice for this particular patient.
Way to loop in the side effects. And then, Kenny, correct me if I'm wrong, but you do get some blood pressure lowering with a GLP-1 also.
So yes, you can have sort of mild to modest blood pressure lowering on GLP-1 agonist, probably in the realm of 3 to 5 points.
Nice. All right. Final votes.
I'm still going to say metformin. I think you guys brought up some great points, but I don't think that Carrie's SGLT2 inhibitors are going to get us there with the A1C goal. And Kenny, I'm just worried about the cost.
Yeah, I totally hear you about the cost. And if it, you know, if we submit that prior authorization and it turns out that it's not covered and getting several $100 out of pocket, then I'm with you on metformin. I will back you. But, you know, if we can get it fully covered 100% with this insurance, which might be possible, then I'm going to stick with the GLP-1 agonists.
So the weight loss.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, taking my SGLT2 inhibitor hat off at the moment, I think I'm with Kenny on this one. He's coming in telling us specifically that weight gain has been a problem, and it sounds like overeating has been part of that. So that's probably where I would go to if I can get it covered easily.
Okay. Awesome. Case number three. We got a 66-year-old guy, history of coronary artery disease, multiple stents in the past, stage 3B CKD, normal BMI. He also has severe cervical stenosis. 4 months ago, his A1C was 6.4. Today, it's 6.9%. His urine albumin is 123 milligrams per gram, and his blood pressure is 145/75.
So I feel obligated to jump in on this one because never have I seen a patient more appropriate for an SGLT2 inhibitor. You guys know those poly pills, right? The little pills that contain 3 or 4 medications in one. I call SGLT2 inhibitors the poly pill with only one med, right? Because you're getting so many different benefits out of just one medication. So this patient doesn't only have diabetes, but also has a history of coronary artery disease, for which SGLT2 inhibitors have shown improvements in major adverse cardiac events and cardiac death. Moving right down the line, stage 3B CKD with some albuminuria makes me really interested in starting him on a medication that will help slow down the progression of his kidney disease. In addition, we're going to get some A1C lowering. We may fix that blood pressure, and we're not going to cause that much weight loss, which I think in this case is important to think about. This gentleman has a normal BMI, and cervical stenosis may not necessarily be able to exercise as much. And if we put him on a GLP-1 agonist, I certainly would be worried about muscle mass loss. And so I think your poly pill in one is the choice in this case, SGLT2 inhibitors all the way.
I wanted to say, you know, that, Carrie, you make a lot of good points, but this is where I'm going to jump on sort of potential side effects as well to make my case. So, you know, what do a lot of 66-year-old men have? Well, they might have large prostates and already have challenge with nocturia and frequent urination. And so that can also be exacerbated by SGLT2 inhibitor. So, you know, it's not absolute contraindication by any means, but something to consider and something where this person may or may not tolerate it. And thinking about GLP-1 agonists, there are a few things to consider here. You know, he has CAD and has had multiple PCIs in the past. Well, we have really strong data that GLP-1 agonists decrease major adverse cardiovascular events, including death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal MIs, and non-fatal strokes. We also know now that at least with semaglutide has been shown to decrease persistent 50% lowering in GFR in patients with CKD3 and significant microalbuminuria. So that may or may not be a class effect, but there's some evidence there for improvement in renal outcomes in patients with CKD who take GLP-1 agonists. You know, so for those reasons, you know, I would really strongly consider GLP-1. Now, you mentioned sort of weight loss, muscle mass. That's definitely an important concern with patients on GLP-1 agonists. I certainly counsel my patients routinely on the importance of doing some sort of strengthening exercises while taking GLP-1 agonists, especially patients who, you know, may be thinner to begin with. So that's probably how I would approach this situation here.
Thanks, Kenny and Carrie. You know, unfortunately, I think metformin's going to have to sit this one out. Our guy has stage 3B CKD. He's not on metformin currently. So we know that when your GFR is in that 30 to 45 window, you really shouldn't be starting metformin. This is a place where if you're already on metformin, you'd want to reduce it to no more than 1,000 milligrams a day. But he's not on it already, so I wouldn't really want to be starting it at this point. So unfortunately, I think I'm going to sit this one out.
Listen, I love the honest question for all of you guys. You know, his A1C is 6.9%. He's 66. Like, would you honestly start a diabetes medication for him versus starting something? He has high blood pressure and he's albuminuria versus just focusing on something that might be blood pressure reducing and also reducing some albuminuria.
You know, that's a great question. And that gets me to sort of, how do we really even think of SGLT2 inhibitors as a medication class in general? I've kind of strayed away from this concept of it being a diabetes med. It's certainly a medication that works well for patients with diabetes, but that's just only one of the things on his long list of problems. So I think of it also a medication for CKD, a medication for CHF, which this patient does not have, but it's really kind of spread and has many different indications beyond just diabetes. So in this case, I actually would, not because I'm targeting any particular A1C, but I'm really trying to impact those comorbidities.
Excellent. All right. Oh, what's your final vote for this one? In diabetes clinic, what would you actually give?
I think I'll have to admit that in reality, I probably favor an SGLT2 inhibitor here for the reasons that Carrie mentioned. Certainly, like if someone develops side effects, then of course we look for alternatives, but I think that would be my preferred option, you know, avoiding significant weight loss in this patient who already has a BMI of 22 and sort of trying to lower his risk both cardiovascularly and renally, as well as maybe a little bit of blood pressure benefit here.
Yeah, I agree. I think the SGLT2 inhibitors would be the ideal medication in this point. I mean, even if we did want to think about how much A1C lowering to get, they're not just not going to drop it by that much. He was 6.4 last time he checked. Now he's 6.8, 6.9. So you'll get him back down to 6.4 easily with initiation of an SGLT2 inhibitor.
I've really started paying closer attention to what's in the products that we use at home, especially with little ones running around. And once you realize what's hiding in conventional cleaners, it's really hard to unsee. And that's why I've genuinely been using Branch Basics. And especially with the holiday season coming up, give the gift that really matters, health, right? Branch Basics is flipping the script. They have a starter kit that is plant and mineral based and basically replaces everything from your bathroom cleaner to your laundry detergent in just one concentrate. So you can use it for washing produce, to makeup brushes, you name it. And because it's refillable, each bottle ends up costing just about $2. Like, that's awesome. And so as someone who's trying to cut down on harmful exposure, I think this is a powerful and simple swap. It's gentle enough for babies and pets and also tough enough to handle real messes. And I've seen it over and over. And honestly, that peace of mind, worth it. So get yourself and your loved ones the gift of clean with Branch Basics. For a limited time, they're actually offering 15% off and free shipping on their premium starter kit when you use the code CoreIM at branchbasics.com/CoreIM. That's 15% off your order at branchbasics.com/CoreIM with the promo code CoreIM. And please support our show and tell them that we sent you. And with that, let's get into the episode.
I remember seeing a colleague of mine walk into the Senate room after a tough night looking way more put together. And I thought, gosh, yeah, they are wearing FIGS. FIG scrubs is specifically made for healthcare workers, doctors, residents, medical students, people like us who need our gear to work as hard as we do. FIG scrubs are lightweight, they're breathable, they're stretchy, they have really thoughtful details that have won me over. Tons of pockets, yes, for all the snacks. They have snag-free zippers, antimicrobial fabric that helps keep things clean. And when there's so much to think about on any given shifts, our scrubs or what we're wearing should not be one of them. FIGS gets that and it shows. And with the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year, which is great because FIGS just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the season. And if you check them out, FIGS is actually offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with a code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
Awesome. All right. Next case. 59-year-old woman working on her feet, a men's homeless shelter. She has severe obesity, BMI of 42, sleep apnea, chronic knee and back pain. She recently found out she had a brain aneurysm and now needs to be on a dual antiplatelet therapy, which means no epidural injections for the pain she's experiencing. And then to make things a little bit more complicated, she also has AFib. For her, the number one thing that she wants to talk to you about in her clinic visit is her pain relief. She also has a history of prediabetes, and in her blood work, you see today that her A1C comes back at 7.4%. What are you guys thinking?
So in this case, you know, this happens in real life. You know, we have patients with prediabetes, and you're sort of almost hoping that the A1C comes back a little higher so that we can try to get that GLP-1 agonist covered for someone who might be interested in weight loss with severe obesity and OSA. If she is interested in weight loss, I don't want to assume, of course, if she's interested in weight loss, I think GLP-1 agonists would work really well for her. The other kind of interesting thing to take into account here, she has obstructive sleep apnea, and recently tirzepatide has been shown to significantly reduce the apnea-hypopnea index in patients with obstructive sleep apnea compared to placebo, and Medicare has started to cover tirzepatide, branded as Zepbound, for that reason. And that may be, you know, primarily due to the weight loss effect itself, but, you know, we're really seeing a significant difference in those patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea. And there is some data as well for GLP-1 agonists with pain from osteoarthritis, for example. So I think there are a lot of reasons to, you know, strongly consider GLP-1 agonist for her.
Lean sauce from team metformin or SGLT2?
It's kind of hard to argue with that, Kenny. I think that there are a lot of great reasons to start a GLP-1 agonist for many of the reasons you mentioned. I'm also sometimes reluctant to start a medication with a high side effect burden in a patient with multiple sort of ongoing medical issues with concern that they may experience a side effect and end up back in the hospital again. So while I may go for GLP-1 agonists in this case, I'd also do so very cautiously. And I think an SGLT2 inhibitor, frankly, wouldn't be a bad choice for a lot of the reasons we mentioned already. She's going to get a lot of different benefits from the medication. There's no clear comorbidities that I think SGLT2 inhibitors target more than others, but she seems like a setup for heart failure. She's got AFib, OSA. Perhaps if we probed a bit more, we might even find that she has symptoms consistent with HFpEF. And there's not that many choices out there that have been shown to be effective for that condition. SGLT2 inhibitors are one of them. So while this may be an obvious case for GLP-1s, I would dig a little deeper and think about an SGLT2 inhibitor if we're able to find the data to support the use of it.
Yeah, I think, again, you guys have brought up some fantastic points. And I agree, we do need to dig a little bit deeper to try to understand what other factors might influence your choice. Thinking about an SGLT2 inhibitor, there's lots of great reasons to start one, but she's a busy lady. She's on her feet all day. If the increase in urinary frequency related to the SGLT2 inhibitor is something that bothers her at work, that's something to be mindful of. Metformin doesn't have the same side effects, side benefits that the GLP-1 receptor agonist and SGLT2 inhibitors have, cardiovascular protection and weight loss and potential use with heart failure, but it's cheap. If that's an issue for her, could be well tolerated. It's pills. So, I mean, I think there are reasons why she might prefer to use metformin as opposed to one of the other drugs. It's just not going to affect the other comorbidities in the same way.
And so it sounds like maybe the final pick is a GLP-1, but if there is like a HFpEF, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, we might lean towards the SGLT2 inhibitor. And just, sorry, back to the weight loss, just to say out loud, what is a weight loss reduction between a GLP-1 versus an SGLT2?
Well, I mean, with SGLT2 inhibitors, we're really only talking about maybe a few kilograms, probably not more than about 3% of body weight.
So on par with metformin.
Yeah, basically. A little sprinkle of weight loss, I guess you could say. One of those polypill effects.
Awesome. And then, with the GLP-1 we're talking about, I think we had said earlier, it's 6 to 11%.
I know, even a little bit more. So just to restate, you know, some of the GLP-1 trials show weight loss up to 15 and even 20% body weight. So that's quite significant, where some of the other medications that exist for, you know, weight loss, phentermine, topiramate, for example, or bupropion, naltrexone, show sort of weight loss in the range of more like 5 to 10%.
Amazing. All right. I have a couple more cases, guys. Now we have a 67-year-old woman, someone with a coronary artery disease in the past, peripheral artery disease also with a bypass, retinopathy, neuropathy, A1C of 9.3%. She's already on glipizide, prasugrel, amlodipine, olmesartan, and inclisiran for hypolipidemia. And she's also on inclisiran, which is a PCSK9 inhibitor for hypolipidemia. Her eGFR at the age of 67 is 62. Her urine albumin creatinine ratio is 27 and her blood pressure is 135 over 88 the clinic today. Any reflections or strong feelings thinking about her?
When you look at her sort of from a bird's eye view, one might call her, the non-technical term I guess I've heard before, is vasculopath. So really what I'm trying to do is kind of make as much impact as I can on her various ASCVD risk factors. I can see that she's already on a pretty powerful LDL lowering medication. She's on an antiplatelet agent. We're controlling blood pressure pretty well. And while she does have diabetes, and this is a diabetes episode, I'm sort of thinking to myself, what are the most important comorbidities that may actually impact her quality of life or her survival? And to me, that's ASCVD. So we want to look for an agent that she will tolerate well, but also can have an impact on reducing major adverse cardiac events and cardiac mortality, because I'm pretty concerned about that for her. And so I really would go for that class in this case.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue too hard against Carrie's points there. I think a couple of things are jumping out to me about this case. One is she already has some significant microvascular complications of diabetes and her A1C is uncontrolled, despite the fact that she's on a sulfonylurea glipizide. So thinking about someone with sort of CKD, you know, in their 60s on a sulfonylurea, that is sort of a setup for complications like hypoglycemia. And so
she doesn't have CKD, right? Her GFR is 62 and your AMU is 27.
So sorry, she has CKD stage 2 approaching stage 3, perhaps. You're correct, not severe CKD. But as she gets older, I would expect that GFR to drop into the CKD3 range fairly soon. And glipizide can be a setup for hypoglycemia. So just, you know, thinking about transitioning her off of a sulfonylurea, you know, a GLP-1 agonist may help do that, may help lower A1C a little bit further than where she's at right now. And we don't need her A1C to be perfect, but her goal may be closer to 8, you know, certainly not as high as 9.3.
Well, I think stopping sulfonylureas is something that we can all rally around. So I'm glad that we can agree on something here.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, you know, the first thing that jumps out at me from this case is the glipizide, and why is it that this lady is on a sulfonylurea at this point? I have to imagine that there is some backstory, and so I'd want to dig into that more before sort of just moving forward and stopping it. But I agree that long-term, this is not a great medication for her to be on, especially with the newer data about sort of hastening beta cell destruction the longer folks are on sulfonylurea. So this isn't a medication that's going to be good for her in the long run. That said, if there is an important reason for her to remain on the glipizide, it's worth noting that metformin can be added to glipizide in a combination pill. So it wouldn't necessarily add to her pill burden if you wanted to add metformin to her regimen to sort of work on your A1C reduction. But again, would really love to know the story behind the glipizide first.
Wow, Tracy, I appreciate your curiosity. Can you repeat your teaching point about glipizide and then the pancreatic cell destruction?
Yeah, I think, you know, with long-term use of sulfonylureas, what has been demonstrated is sort of a hastening of beta cell destruction, meaning folks are needing to be transitioned over to insulin-based regimens sooner. And so our practice has really been to try to limit both the use of sulfonylureas as well as the duration of sulfonylureas to try to not be kind of counterproductive in terms of our diabetes management.
All right. What would you do for a 67-year-old who has so many vascular comorbidities, has retinopathy, neuropathy, not significant nephropathy yet, CKD stage 2 maybe on a glipizide? What would you ask to do in clinic? What's your final vote? A1C of 9.3%.
I think I'd probably try an SGLT2 inhibitor here and discontinue the glipizide right off the bat, assuming, you know, as Tracy said, we sort of dug into the reasons why, unless the patient...
That's interesting, because the SGLT2 inhibitor will only give you a 0.5 to 1% A1C reduction. What you're thinking, it sounds like the larger picture, she will benefit from an SGLT2 inhibitor.
I think in managing the comorbidities, I mean, I was about to say, unless, you know, she is particularly interested in weight loss as well, in which case that would change me over to a GLP-1 agonist. But if she's not, I think for comorbidity management here, an SGLT2 inhibitor might be slightly preferable.
I was going to say that's so interesting because I think, Kenny, you've convinced me to go for a GLP-1 receptor agonist because I'm thinking, you know, she's on the glipizide and that's getting her to an A1C of 9.3. So if we take the glipizide off, not only are we going to need to come down from the 9.3, but we're going to want to make sure that that A1C is not going to go even higher with the removal of the sulfonylurea. So I'm thinking GLP-1s do have benefits in terms of the coronary artery disease, in terms of the potential for diabetic kidney disease, and also it's going to have a greater A1C reduction. So I'm in team GLP-1 receptor agonist for this.
Let me actually come back and kind of agree with what you said before, Tracy, about the fact that this patient's medication list is a little unusual, not for what's on it, but kind of for what's missing from it, right? There's no metformin, there's no statin. That's kind of a glaring absence. And it makes me think that this patient is somebody who experiences a high burden of medication-related adverse effects. And with that in mind, I still think, you know, SGLT2 inhibitors, while they do have some side effects, certainly not nearly as universal as GLP-1 agonists. Starting a new injectable for her, she's on inclisiran, but that's given only every 6 months at the doctor's office. So that may be a bit of a sell. Nevertheless, I think you guys both make really good points.
Thanks. Kenny, as I'm curious, Tracy's for team GLP-1 and Carrie's sticking to his SGLT2. Where do you land as a tiebreaker?
It'll be a tiebreaker. Well, I guess I'm going to hedge when I say slightly, and I think this really depends on all other things being equal. I think this would depend a little bit on whether, you know, with the comorbidities like cardiovascular disease and peripheral vascular disease, is this sort of a thinner, frailer person, or is this someone who might have obesity and might be motivated for weight loss? If the former, I really would favor the SGLT2 inhibitor, and if the latter, I think the GLP-1 agonist might make a lot of sense.
Yes. All right. Also, I think it's going to be a wrap for cases. Any last words? Anything we missed in terms of like salient points in terms of distinctions that we want to get across?
I think one thing we didn't hit on that is a sort of emerging benefit of GLP-1 agonists is the potential benefit in metabolic-associated steatosis of the liver. And, you know, there are more and more studies now showing that GLP-1 agonists may improve or resolve steatohepatitis without worsening of fibrosis and maybe even by reducing liver fibrosis by one stage. So that is a potentially emerging reason to really consider GLP-1 agonists more in our patients with liver disease.
Awesome. Anything else, Carrie, Tracy?
Yeah, I want to go back to the kidneys for a second because I know we've mentioned GLP-1 agonists impacting kidney outcomes. And while there are some papers that show that, I do want to make another case for the fact that SGLT2 inhibitors just have a lot more broad and deep evidence in this space and really should be a go-to drug. Most of those studies that showed an impact of the GLP-1 agonists for CKD consisted of patients that were not already on an SGLT2 inhibitor. So it's a bit hard to parse that apart.
That's great to know. Maybe we can have each of you guys go through the medication you were defending and just like what are the salient points of when to consider it and maybe when to not consider it. Tracy, maybe I'll have you go first with metformin.
Sure. So, you know, I think metformin is tried and true. We have the most number of years of experience with this medication. I think for many, many years, it was recommended as the first line agent for type 2 diabetes. I think it's only really in the last 3-4 years that the algorithms recommended by the ADA have changed to say that you could consider an SGLT2 or GLP-1 receptor agonist as first line. So I think, you know, there still is a role for metformin to play. It's inexpensive. It's available on all of the retail pharmacy $4 drug lists and very easy for folks to obtain. Again, I do recommend using the extended release formulation, which is on those retail pharmacy discount lists. So really shouldn't be a reason to be prescribing immediate release metformin at this point with the higher side effect risk, but generally well tolerated, great A1C reduction, some weight loss, although certainly not as much as the other classes, and also can be combined with other pills and the same pill. So thinking about reducing polypharmacy, you can combine metformin with SGLT2 inhibitors, with sulfonylureas, with DPP-4 inhibitors. So I think it's a very versatile medication for folks to use.
As long as their GFR is above 30?
No, for sure. So, you know, goal dose of metformin being as high as 2 grams per day, as long as your GFR is above 45. And then if you're already on metformin, again, you would reduce that goal dose to 1 gram per day if your GFR is between 30 and 45. And if you're not on metformin, you would not be starting metformin if your GFR is below 45.
Amazing. All right, Carrie, what are the salient points about an SGLT2 inhibitor in terms of A1C reduction, weight reduction, cardiac, renal outcomes, blood pressure, and the other nuances to mention?
Thanks, Freya. Yeah, so SGLT2 inhibitors are the drug that does a little bit of everything. You get about a half a point to a point of A1C reduction, a little bit of weight loss, and a little bit of blood pressure impact, but really shine in areas of improving outcomes related to CKD, especially proteinuric CKD. Patients with a history of ASCVD or patients with any variety of CHF really should be your go-to drug in those cases. You probably want to avoid SGLT2 inhibitors in patients with history of urinary tract infections, at least if they're frequent or have resistant organisms or hospitalizations related to that. And I also would stray away from them in any patient where you're concerned for a risk for DKA. They are associated with euglycemic DKA. And so while they're great drugs, no drug is a free ride. It's often the right choice for many patients with diabetes.
Can I ask you about that for a second? So many people have UTIs. What's your threshold about the number of UTIs before you're like, no, let's stop this. SGLT2 or not start it.
You know, as long as the UTIs remain simple, I will allow that to be a shared decision. I will sort of weigh that against the benefit that I think we're getting from the SGLT2 inhibitor. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that. But as soon as we're dealing with resistant organisms and or severe infections like pyelonephritis or something along those lines, I probably would back off.
Okay, great. Kenny?
Sure. So, you know, for GLP-1 agonists, you know, I consider them first in patients with uncontrolled diabetes and obesity. I think they're excellent drugs in this setting. They provide potent A1C lowering and significant weight loss. I'd also consider using GLP-1 agonists to reduce cardiovascular risk, as well as progression of renal disease in patients with diabetes. In patients with obesity, with or without diabetes, you can consider using them for improved outcomes in obstructive sleep apnea, as well as metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis. And then there are a few things I would consider that would make me more hesitant to use them. You know, as we discussed, the primary one is cost. So if patients have difficulty with insurance coverage or don't have insurance coverage and are needing to pay out of pocket, they're quite expensive. They do come with sort of some common adverse effects, such as nausea, bloating, or even vomiting, and more likely to sort of experience those side effects if patients are eating high fat content meals. So patients who might not have access to optimal nutrition because of cost or other factors, definitely something to consider in terms of side effect profile. And there are some absolute contraindications to consider: history of pancreatitis, history of medullary thyroid cancer, then these medications are contraindicated.
You guys were wonderful. Thank you so much. I learned so much. That's always a good sign.
And that is a wrap for this episode. Let us know if you enjoyed this quick case-based debate format. Thank you so much and take care.
Tired of outdated PBM rules? The Luminate RX is your secret weapon. We don't just flip the script, we hand you the pen. With solutions that put you in the driver's seat to deliver clarity, control, and serious savings to clients. The Luminate RX. No nonsense, just results.